Our headlines. President Biden and President Yoon pledged to expand the scope and scale of U.S.-South Korea military exercises to ramp up deterrence against the North. Russia cuts off gas flow to Finland over its refusal to pay for future supplies in rubles. And Bahraini opposition groups react as the Saudi Supreme Court upholds death sentences against two Bahraini men. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. U.S. and South Korean presidents have vowed to expand the scope and scale of military exercises by their countries to ramp up deterrence against the North. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol and his U.S. counterpart Joe Biden met in Seoul earlier on Saturday. Biden said the 70-year alliance between Washington and Seoul was built on working together to deter Pyongyang. Biden is in South Korea on the first leg of his Asian tour that will take him to Japan as well. His trip to Seoul met with protests on Friday and Saturday, with protesters voicing anger at the military cooperation between their country and the U.S. They argued that the cooperation would provoke an arms race. They also say Washington's aggressive military strategy will escalate tensions in the region. Our correspondent Jennifer Chang in Seoul tells us more about why some groups there are opposed to the alliance between South Korea and the U.S. Take a listen.
They are polarized. One group consists of older South Koreans who favor the U.S.-South Korea alliance. The other part of the protesters consists of younger South Koreans who want the alliance to be over. They say it endangers peace on the Korean Peninsula and increases the chance of war, saying that President Biden's visit to South Korea is not good for the South. The President of America is meeting the newly elected President of South Korea, Yoon Suk-yeol, and is going to be stressing the power of the South Korea-U.S. military and economic alliance. A total of 10,600 or so protesters are out on the street, and the anti-U.S. protests are all over the place, scattered all over. President Biden is staying at the Grand Hyatt Seoul Hotel. There has been an anti-U.S. protest and picketing there. There has been an additional protest here at the Defense Ministry, where the South Korean president, who's been newly elected, Yoon Suk-yeol, will be working from.
Russia has just cut off flow of natural gas to Finland after it refused to pay for future supplies in the Russian national currency. Finland's energy firm says, though regrettable, the halt will cause no disruptions in the gas transmission network. Gazprom says it's been carefully preparing for this situation. Last Saturday, Russia also cut electricity deliveries to Finland over payment issues. The developments come as Finland and Sweden are planning to join NATO. The two submitted their bids on Wednesday. Russia is opposed to their move, citing security threats caused by NATO's expansion. Moscow has promised retaliation should Finland and Sweden join the Western military alliance. Our correspondent Marina Kurtunova in Moscow tells us how European countries have responded to Russian demands for payments in rubles.
Russia's Gazprom expert announced on Friday that Gazprom also failed to pay for the natural gas deliveries in April. Poland, Bulgaria, and Finland refused to comply with Moscow's demand, and deliveries to these countries were stopped. Finnish promised to apply to arbitration. So as you know, Russian president said on March 23rd that unfriendly states must pay for Russian gas in rubles, saying it refused to accept payments under gas those states in compromised currencies, particularly meaning dollars and. As you know, Germany, Italy allowed companies to open ruble accounts to pay for gas. So the reports say that Berlin told German gas importers that they could open ruble accounts to pay for energy, provided that payments to Russia's Gazprom Bank are made in foreign currency.
Now, as our correspondent Johnny Miller reports from Mariupol, which is now under Russian control, Russian forces are moving out of the town and heading for the heart of the conflict zone in Luhansk, Donbass region. Take a listen.
I'm currently just outside Mariupol, where the last of the Ukrainian soldiers in the Azov battalion are finally surrendering. It's a great victory for the Russians to take Mariupol, but the Ukrainians are also saying that it's a victory for them. Why? Because those fighters at Azovstal were able to hold off or take up time in the Russian army. The Russian army had to surround that steel plant for a long time, stopping Russian soldiers moving elsewhere in the war. And in part, that's correct. When we were coming up this road this morning from Donetsk, we had to wait by the side of a country road for about half an hour as an entire Russian battle group moved past us. Dozens of tanks, dozens of supply trucks, all leaving Mariupol now and heading to where the fighting is in Donbass and Luhansk. Right now, there, the Russian army is trying to encircle the bulk of the Ukrainian army. They're having success using artillery. Even Zelensky, who normally downplays Russian successes, has said today that it is, in his words, hell in Donbass as the Russians use artillery. Many of the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches are dying without even being able to see the Russian army. This road here, we're heading back to Donetsk now. There's a straight road and there's a safe road. Because on the straight road, there is only about 4 kilometers away at one part is a village held by the Ukrainian army, and they often shell cars coming along. A reminder, the Ukrainians still hold huge parts of Donbass. But the Battle of Mariupol is over. The battle for Donbass and Luhansk is going to accelerate in the next few days.
The situation is escalating between Russia and the West as Moscow pledges a proper response to a bid by Sweden and Finland to join NATO. Hashtag trending reviews the related developments posted on social media.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, your host Ali Reza. The West's confrontation with Russia is escalating as the two Nordic states of Finland and Sweden announce their desire to join the NATO military alliance. Stay with us to see some reactions to the story through the lens of social media. The bid by Finland and Sweden to join NATO has prompted Moscow's immediate response. Russia's defense minister says that his country will take adequate countermeasures against threats to its western borders, and that includes the addition of 12 new units in its western military district. The rising tension between Russia and the West has sparked a wave of concern among social media users. People are afraid that these dangerous developments may lead to a third world war, which would include nuclear confrontation. And now let's read some comments. The first one comes from Eggplant Shill. Sweden and Finland joining NATO is a massive escalation that threatens a blockade of Russia's access to the Atlantic. It does not matter if NATO calls itself a mutual defense organization. You do not back a nuclear power into a corner. Manuja, I think is how you pronounce it, said Finland and Sweden applied for NATO membership. Finland shares a 1,340-kilometer border with Russia. It won independence from Moscow in 1917. If accepted, their presence would instantly more than double the border between NATO countries and Russia from around 750 miles to around 1,600. Chuchi Face said Russia is to expand its military presence near its western borders as a retaliation against Sweden and Finland's application to join NATO. And over here we have a comment by Green Flame the Fourth. The U.S. that is afraid to engage Russia in a direct conflict militarily is offering to protect Finland and Sweden when they join NATO. What a joke. What the U.S. is cleverly doing with NATO is principally to ensure that all future wars are fought in Europe without being taken to U.S. soil. Meanwhile, Turkey has raised objections to the two Nordic countries' bid to join NATO, blocking the organization from proceeding with the accession process. Turkish officials have also accused both Finland and Sweden of supporting and harboring anti-Ankara terrorists. Our next batch of comments starts with one by The Third Rail with Omar. Finland and Sweden have been harboring the PKK, a group designated as a terrorist organization by Turkey, the United States, and the European Union. Now that they got the jitters from Russia and want to join NATO, everyone is upset at Turkey for raising concerns. Izhar Chaudhary said Turkey's opposition regarding Finland's and Sweden's accession to NATO is, in principle, correct. This move by the two countries is only to please the U.S., which will only escalate rather than end the war in the region. Linda Brown said it is absolutely staggering that Turkey, which has the second largest military in NATO next to the U.S., was never consulted about whether Sweden and Finland should join the military alliance. Of course, the people of Sweden and Turkey were never consulted either. Now, here we have a tweet by Bosonaugras Mabulamashin. He said, the biggest features of Sweden and Finland for NATO are that they are outposts of England and Germany. If Turkey can prolong the process when there is a danger of war, America must support it. I think the real subject of the bargain should be American strategies in Central Asia. Many believe that NATO's eastward expansion is the root cause of the problem, as Russia sees its security at stake. They accuse the U.S. of trying to maintain its hegemony over Europe by bringing the war to European soil. The final batch of comments starts with a tweet by Mr. Brain and Backbone. The superpower in NATO is the USA. When the USA wants something, it forces it by using genuine reasons or by fabricating one. Weapons of mass destruction in Iraq with support of NATO. This is bullying. The fear of Russia that Finland and Sweden have is the same fear that some non-NATO countries have of the USA. Indiana Jones said the Russia-Ukraine war was planned well in advance by the dark elite, hashtag Davos, that pulls the strings of many Western leaders. That's the reason behind NATO's provocative expansion plus arming of Ukraine. The shady elite behind U.S. and allies sees Russia plus China as a threat. Ukraine is just a pawn. A.S. Francis has a tweet that reads, the expansion of NATO is a blatant provocation which may trigger another war by Russia with the former republics of the Soviet Union. The expansion of NATO will pave the way for Russia to restore the Soviet Union for security reasons. And our final comment comes from Paolo Pancho Ribeiro. The reason countries lobby to join NATO is not because of what the U.S. wants, but because they fear Russian imperial expansion, and this aligns with U.S. desire to contain Russia and maintain U.S. hegemony over Europe. And with that, we have come to the end of another edition of Hashtag Trending. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
Welcome back. British Home Secretary Priti Patel in hot water. She is said to be controlled by a shady group that manages spy agency MI6, inspired research and influence operation. Investigative news website The Gray Zone says leaked emails clearly show the cabal's apparent influence on Patel and her policies. It says the group is being guided in its covert operation in part by former spy chief Richard Dearlove. The Gray Zone says the cabal also sought to seize power over energy policy and displace a government minister. The revelations raise serious questions about Patel's fitness to rule on WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange's extradition to the U.S. Earlier this month, the Gray Zone exposed a plot against former U.K. Prime Minister Theresa May. It said a shadowy intelligence cabal conspired to replace May with Boris Johnson to secure a hard Brexit deal with the EU. In Australia, vote counting is underway after millions of people cast their ballots in the national election. The election results will determine who controls the House of Representatives and Senate, as well as a new Prime Minister. Official polls show the Labour Party has a 47% lead over the ruling Liberal National Coalition on a two-party preferred basis. If the Labour Party wins, it could mean the end of a decade of Conservative rule in the government. Inflation and climate change are the main concerns of the voters. Australia's inflation has surged to its highest in over two decades. That's higher than the current wage growth, leaving many Australians concerned about rising living costs. Saudi Arabia faces criticism after its Supreme Court upheld death sentences against two young Bahraini nationals over false terror charges. Several Bahraini opposition groups have called the ruling unfair and arbitrary. They say the ruling was issued based on confessions extracted under torture. The groups have called on the international community to prevent Saudi authorities from carrying out the sentences. Human rights organizations and social media activists have reacted too, calling for the immediate release of the two Bahraini nationals. Sadiq Majid Thamer and Jafar Mohammed Sultan were arrested in May 2015. Saudi Arabia accused them of smuggling explosives into the kingdom and involvement in terrorist activities. Bahraini political activist Sundas Al-Asad argues that the decision by the Saudi court to uphold death sentences against Bahraini nationals is a politically motivated move. Take a listen.
Unfortunately, the two Bahraini nationals are being purchased for political reasons. Those two young men have been tortured, have been ill-treated, and have been subjected to an enforced disappearance for likely more than 100 days without accessing legal help. So those two defendants have been persecuted for political reasons and have been tortured, as I have mentioned, for their peaceful activism. And Saudi Arabia, unfortunately, follows the same method of Bahrain, which is persecuting political activists for no reason. The only reason if they have committed something which is calling for freedom, calling for basic human rights.
Syria says its air defenses have intercepted Israeli missiles during a fresh attack near the capital, Damascus. Syria's defense ministry says the strikes left three people dead and led to some material damage. Earlier, Syrian media reported that air defenses confronted quote-unquote hostile targets in the sky in the Damascus countryside. The report said the Israeli attack also caused a fire near Damascus International Airport, delaying a number of flights. Israel earlier launched a volley of missiles on Syria on May the 14th. Killing five Syrian soldiers. Our correspondent in Damascus, Muhammad Ali, tells us more about the repeated acts of Israeli aggression against Syria.
According to an official military source, at about 11 p.m. local time in Damascus, Israel carried out a missile attack, a surface-to-surface missile attack, which was launched from the occupied Syrian Golan and hit targets in areas in the southern countryside of Damascus. Right away, Syria's air defenses, as usual, intercepted the attack, shooting down most of the enemy missiles. However, it seems that some of them did hit their targets, because three persons were killed as a result of this attack. Now, definitely, this is not the first kind of attack, especially this year, or at least this month, in which Israel stepped up its attacks, whether in central Syria, in areas like Musyaf and Hama, or around the Syrian capital, Damascus, or in the south, around Al-Quneitra. Syria always sends letters to the United Nations Security Council and Secretary General with regards to such attacks. But so far, despite the tens of letters, there are still international silence about this. Still, there is no action being taken as an independent country is being attacked, a sovereign country is being attacked.
And with that, we'll come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 29, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the occasion of Quds Day. In the first part of this speech, Imam Khamenei expressed his gratitude for the Iranian nation for their participation in Quds Day. Once more, Quds Day has arrived. Holy Quds calls all Muslims in the world. The activities in Jenin has enraged the Zionist regime to the point of madness. This is while 20 years ago, the usurping regime killed 200 people in the Jenin refugee camp in response to the death of a few Zionists in Naharia, with the purpose of forever concluding the Jenin matter. Polls show that almost 70% of the Palestinians in the 1948 and 1967 lands and in the surrounding camps encouraged the Palestinian leaders to carry out attacks on the Zionist regime. This is an important phenomenon because it signifies the complete preparedness of the Palestinians to confront the usurping regime, and it provides the Mujahid organizations with the freedom to take military action whenever they deem necessary.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The jihadi moves of the people of Palestine in the two northern and southern parts of the 1948 lands, and at the same time the massive rallies in Jordan and Eastern Quds, the brave defense of the Al-Aqsa Mosque by Palestinian youth, and the military maneuvers in Gaza indicate that all of Palestine has turned into an arena of resistance. At the present time, the people of Palestine are unanimous about continuing this struggle on the path of God. These incidents and what has occurred in Palestine in recent years is a seal of annulment on all schemes for compromise with the Zionist enemy. This is because no scheme or plan about Palestine is implementable in the absence of Palestine or against the consent of its owners, the Palestinians. This means that all former agreements such as the Oslo Accord, the Arabian two-state solution, the deal of the century, and the recent humiliating attempts for the normalization of relations have been nullified.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all. I wanna thank you for bringing me home.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
A Kenyan court has ruled that British troops must face charges that, while high on cocaine, they started a fire that destroyed over 12,000 acres of a Kenyan wildlife reserve. Now, the crime took place at Loldaiga Hills Ranch, a wildlife reserve used by the British Army Training Unit in Kenya. Lawyer Kelvin Kubai, appearing for the Loldaiga community, speaks here after the verdict.
The upshot of the matter is that our court has jurisdiction to pursue the matter occurring as a result of the British Army fire that occurred in Loldaiga about an year ago.
Hello, this is Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Now, this week, we are focusing on a landmark ruling by a Kenyan court that British troops training in Kenya have no immunity for crimes committed while in the country. But even after this ruling, reports emerge that British troops training in this East African nation have used hazardous white phosphorus. When will this impunity come to an end? Now, the second part of our program will be on plans by the European Union to step up cooperation with African countries to help replace imports of Russian natural gas. We're asking, are African countries ready to be Europe's main source of gas? Our experts will give us their incisive analysis on today's topics, so join us till the end of our show.
UK troops lose immunity in Kenya. An environmental and land court in Kenya recently ruled that the country's courts have jurisdiction to hear and determine criminal and civil matters involving British troops. Following the ruling, British troops involved in deliberately burning down 12,000 acres last year have lost their right to diplomatic immunity against lawsuits in Kenya.
Maxwell Gishuhi, a lawyer for the African Center for Corrective and Preventive Action, which was part of the legal action against the British Army Training Unit in Kenya, believes the ruling will have impact across the world.
What the court has done, and we must applaud it, is that the court has set a precedent which is groundbreaking, not only in Kenya, not only in Africa, but globally. As you may know, the British forces operate in various parts of the world. And this is a judgment that will be used across the globe, wherever they operate.
Well, for more on the implication of these court ruling against British troops committing crimes in Kenya, we contacted Jonathan Ofei Anser, a journalist and a commentator on African affairs. Thanks, sir, for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Now, how will this court verdict impact on the presence of British troops in Kenya?
I mean, for quite a long time, and most of these British subjects on training in Kenya, I mean, I have disregarded or have acted with impunity in Kenya. There have been so many previous cases where they flouted the laws and acted with impunity. But Kenyans, you know, have realized this and are taking measures, you know, to stop this, you know, action with impunity in their country. So I do expect the latest problem to be resolved, to be adequately tackled by the Kenyan authorities.
A Kenyan man was crushed to death by a vehicle as local people rushed to help put out the fire started by the British troops in Loldaiga Conservancy. The community around the conservancy also continues to suffer, as their lawyer explains here.
We still have cases of human-animal conflict. They're still losing their crops. They've now lost 3 seasons. They cannot be able to harvest. So we've lost millions and millions of money, while local businesses in town gain just a few coins from the interactions and profit.
The British Army Training Unit, Kenya, denied the charges brought against it and claimed the troops were protected from prosecution by diplomatic immunity. Why was Britain's Ministry of Defence attempting to have the case dismissed on the basis that the British Army had diplomatic immunity when it was clear these troops committed a crime?
And that's, you know, it indicates, you know, sometimes the double standards of many Western nations, including Britain, when it comes to Africa. Because the British Army waived diplomatic immunity for their operations, training operations in Kenya a long time ago. So for them, you know, to sort of invoke that diplomatic immunity again also points to the impunity and also the disregard, you know, for the laws, you know, of Kenya, for the laws of the ruling country. So look, Britain, you know, would like any other, like I said, like many other, typical of many other Western countries, will try to adopt any means to avoid or to escape culpability for their misdeeds, you know, in Africa, Kenya in particular. But I'm not sure they are going to succeed this time.
Weeks after the Kenyan court ruled that British troops are not immune from crimes committed in the country, another scandal emerged. James Heppey, the Parliamentary Undersecretary of State for the Armed Forces, admitted that British troops used dangerous white phosphorus mortar rounds during training in Kenya. British MP Kenny McCaskill, who uncovered the use of white phosphorus in Kenya by the army, said the dangers of the chemical are well documented and have caused injury and misery in many conflicts. Now, how serious is the use of these hazardous, dangerous white phosphorus chemical, and how has it impacted the locals?
Yes, again, this again also shows, you know, it's an indication of the scant regard the West, Britain included, half of Africa. I mean, we have so many cases of toxic goods being dumped in Africa. And this is another case in point, because the British know how harmful, you know, this phosphorus weapons can be. Okay, I mean, the British Army withdrew it from service way back in 2019 after discovering that it contained a poisonous explosive chemical called tetryl. Okay, this tetryl, you know, affects the nervous, the respiratory, and the digestive system. As in Britain, the British Army stopped its use, you know, in 2019. The U.S. stopped its manufacture in way back in 1973. And the Pentagon, you know, has started destroying any stockpiles of the phosphorus. So why keep on using it for training in Africa, in Kenya? Look, there are two instances where one 13-year-old boy suffered lacerations when he came across, he touched, you know, an explosive containing that phosphorus. And another 13-year-old boy lost his eye and two limbs after coming in contact with that explosive. So why should Kenya keep, should Britain keep on using this poisonous, you know, chemical weapon in Kenya? It's a question that, or it's a matter that the Kenya authorities need to tackle and tackle vigorously.
History shows that British forces have been violating human rights and flouting military pacts signed with Kenya. A young Kenyan lady was murdered and her body thrown in a septic tank by a British soldier in 2012. The murder of Agnes Wanjiru adds to the long list of atrocities committed by troops in Kenya. Nidaritu Murithi, the governor of Laikipia County in Kenya, where the crime took place, says troops involved in crimes must be prosecuted, even if that will put in jeopardy a defense pact between London and Nairobi.
Now, you have raised the question that all prosecuting soldiers here would threaten the defense pact between Kenya and the UK. So be it. No defense pact can give foreign soldiers license to kill our citizens.
It is now 10 years since a young Kenyan woman, Agnes Wanjiru, was murdered by a British soldier in Kenya. Can we expect justice in this case?
Yes, we should expect justice, because the family of that Kenyan woman, you know, in question, you know, has instructed a British law firm, Lay and Day. I mean, Lay and Day, you know, has represented, you know, a group of Kenyans in the past and won in the British courts. So the case, they've taken up the case for that woman called Wanjiru or something, yeah, for that woman in the British court. So we expect, you know, to get justice for that poor woman.
Amnesty International and Impact say that at least 650 women had been raped by British troops between 1965 and 2001, and that there was a conspiracy of silence on these crimes. Now, human rights organizations say there is a deliberate and shocking attempt to obstruct justice for Kenyan victims of UK military abuses. Now, what's your take on this?
The UK authorities cannot, you know, obstruct or cannot escape justice, because I know that Kenya has a long history, I mean, of tackling or fighting abuses by the Kenya, by the British authorities. I mean, even historical abuses. There was one case recently where the descendants of and even some survivors of the British atrocities committed against the Mau Mau in the pre-independence days were brought to court, and they won. Okay, and I know that Kenya will not rest until they receive justice for all the atrocities, all the wrongdoings perpetrated or committed by the British troops in the country. So I'm very confident of a very just outcome, you know, for the Kenyans.
All thanks to Jonathan Ofei Ansah for his insight. Indeed, there are high expectations that Britain's crimes and impunity in Kenya will end as the country's judiciary assess the sovereignty of this East African nation. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall discuss plans by the European Union to import more gas from Africa amid the crisis in Ukraine. Stay with us.
Can Africa replace Russia's gas in Europe? You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Amid the ongoing conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the European Union is reportedly planning to boost energy cooperation with African countries. Now, this is expected to replace Russian natural gas imports and reduce dependence on Moscow by almost two-thirds this year.
According to projection, Africa's LNG production is forecast at 73 billion cubic meters in 2022. A draft EU document says countries in Africa, in particular Nigeria, Senegal, and Angola, offer largely untapped potential for liquefied natural gas.
Italy has already taken the first step by signing an agreement with Angola last month to increase gas supplies from the southern African country. Tete Antonio, the Angolan Minister of External Relations, speaks here after the gas agreement with Italy.
This is the first step of many, because we have a diversified cooperation with Italy. I think everything is in place for strong cooperation, and especially a strategic partnership.
Now, for more on plans by Europe to import more gas from Africa, we contacted Paolo Raffone, the Secretary General of CIPI Foundation. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
No problem. My pleasure.
Now, our first question to you, sir. Can Africa replace Russia's gas exports to Europe?
Well, this is a theoretical question, because, in fact, There is the possibility to use some of the gas reserves in certain African countries like Mozambique or Nigeria or even Congo. But the real problem is the extraction and the logistics to transport it to Europe. So it is a very, I would say, medium-term target that, yes, can be made technically, but it will take time and a huge investment of funds to make it feasible.
Most African countries lack infrastructure in the gas sector and have to rely on Western multinationals. If these challenges are not addressed, Africa will not reap the benefits of its vast gas reserves. An official of the Abuja Chamber of Commerce and Industry speaks here on the challenges facing the gas sector.
You all know that gas is cheap, gas is clean, and gas is green. So why are we not utilizing our gas resources in Nigeria effectively? That's the concern, and that's the narrative we want to bring to the fore. The biggest challenge is infrastructure. Infrastructure is the biggest challenge, and the government should allow private sector partner with them to enable them build infrastructure in Nigeria too, so that the average Nigerian can have access to gas resources. That's the biggest challenge that we have.
What can African countries do to avoid exploitation by Western oil and gas multinationals?
Well, because of the huge investments necessary in the African countries to operationalize the extraction and the treatment of gas for its transportation, it's evident that this is a sort of a new colonial kind of intervention, and I have serious doubts that the African countries would like to go back in history with the Europeans heavily involved into the situation at domestic level to have the gas extracted. So I think it will create a lot of reactions among the population, and even certain governments would not be so keen to participate in this endeavor.
A major concern regarding Africa replacing Russia's gas in Europe is the financial aspect. Nigeria's Minister of State for Petroleum Resources, Timi Prasilva, says his country is ready to offer its services as an alternative gas supplier to Europe. In a meeting with European Union diplomats in Abuja, he urged the EU to increase investments in gas and hydrocarbons in Nigeria to be able to meet the bloc's energy needs.
We should please work together towards the future as partners, and that Nigeria will be very willing, and we are very well positioned to be a reliable partner, reliable supplier of energy to Europe.
Now, how can African countries finance the continent's gas project to avoid unfair preconditions imposed by European countries?
There is no way that African countries by themselves can finance the needed investments to have the gas produced and stocked and then transported. So the possibility is only to get loans that can be given by European financial institutions or the IMF, World Bank, and so on. But again, it will take time, and the conditions attached to those loans may be very unfavorable for the African countries. So I see it a remote possibility. Also, the mood of these countries is not so keen to join the Western-led war with Russia. So we have seen it in the United Nations Assembly vote and in other occasions. I would say that also should be seen that the only two African countries which have been brought to Ramstein by the Americans in their meeting against Russia, only two, Kenya and Liberia. So this shows that the continent, made out of 53 countries, is not so keen to follow the Americans. Even Morocco, that was present in Ramstein, was brought there reluctantly. So I really see it as an idea that can work, but in a completely different setup from today and in the medium long term.
Last year, Nigeria's President Buhari announced the Decade of Gas, an initiative designed to ensure the people of this country benefit from this natural resource.
Gas has enormous potential to diversify and uplift Nigeria's economy, given the country's potential of about 600 trillion cubic feet of gas and the rising global demand for cleaner energy sources has offered Nigeria an opportunity to exploit gas resources for the good of the country. We intend to seize this opportunity. Nigeria LNG contributes about 1% to GDP and has contributed $114 billion United States dollars in revenues over the years.
How can African countries supply gas to Europe yet barely meet their domestic needs?
I think that the sovereignty on the natural resources should be the objective of all African states. Already they are being exploited by other kinds of mineral extractions. Let's think Congo, but even Nigeria. And we see all the problems that are linked to these activities financed and operated by Western multinationals. I think that the Africans this time will not abide to a new neocolonial style action by Europeans just because they need suddenly their gas and therefore accept any condition. It will be a lengthy negotiation.
Western powers seeking to isolate Russia over Ukraine are disappointed at what they see as lukewarm support from African nations at the UN General Assembly. As our guest mentioned earlier, most African countries are not aligned with Western policies and stances on the Ukraine conflict. Now, how will this impact on the continent's move to replace Russia's gas in Europe?
I believe so. Yes, the Africans are much more self-confident today in certain countries. Let's take South Africa, which is the most prominent and active on this ground, is much more interested to be part of emerging powers game, so the famous BRICS in conjunction with Russia and China, than to go back to the old colonial relations with Europe. So I do think that politically Africa is quite different from what it was, of course, and will not accept easily to replace the Russian gas at the cost of their state building and reaffirmation of sovereignty that they have gained only a few decades ago. So they will be very wary on accepting any conditions from Europe. And we see also the nervousness in Europe is so high that they are trying to revive the Iranian nuclear deal in order to have another opportunity to get the gas instead of Russia. But the reaction of Iran has been very cold at the moment. They're not rushing into it.
We'd like to thank Paolo Raffone for his insight, and we'll keep our eyes on this subject in our future programs. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. You can send us your comments through our social media handle, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we're going to be looking at a question. And this question is regarding one of the surahs and chapters of the Holy Quran, which is Surah Nas. Surah Nas, as you know, is the last surah of the Holy Quran. That gives it some special significance and importance. It's also one of the shorter surahs of the Holy Quran. And in the first three verses of this surah, God Almighty asks the Prophet and indirectly asks us to seek refuge in God from the insinuations and the temptations and the whisperings of the devil. And in this three verses, God Almighty refers to himself not as Allah, but refers to himself using three attributes, which are Rabbin Nas, Malikin Nas, Ilahin Nas. Rabb means Lord, Malik means sovereign or king, and Ilah means object of worship. Literally means object of worship. We often translate it as God or, you know, demigod or things like this. But actually, the correct translation of this from Arabic to English is object of worship, something that is worship or something that is deserving to be worshipped. So the question that we want to pose today is, why is it that God has referred to himself using these three sifats or these three divine attributes? Obviously, there's a reason behind it. He could have used some other word to refer to himself, but he referred to himself using these three attributes. So we can analyze this question and resolve this problem in the following way. We know that when we face a danger, we take refuge in something that has the ability to repel that danger from us. Right. So God Almighty refers to himself using these three attributes because, in effect, these three attributes, these three qualities that he possesses, have this ability to repel this danger from us. First of all, he is the Lord of men, meaning he is the person who nourishes men, who takes care of them, who takes care of their needs, secures their needs for them. And therefore, one of the needs of men is that, you know, these dangers that man faces, which comes in the form and is manifested as this these insinuations that the devil tempts him with, right? He repels them from man and protects man from them. God Almighty is the sovereign. He is, when we say sovereign, he's the king. We don't mean like he is a worldly king, right? Kings have a power which is temporary, fleeting, transient. One day it belongs to them, the next day they're overthrown and it doesn't belong to them, right? And obviously their rule is a unreal, their power, the power that they have, the sovereignty they have is unreal, right? Even if it's based on physical force, right, it's something that's unreal, right? For example, if they have to give a formal order in order for it to be carried out, right? It's not like the power that a human being has over his body, right, which is in which case, right, the body doesn't have the ability to reject the order of the soul, right, or the intention of the soul. When the soul gives an order, or the mind gives an order to a body, right, the body has to obey. The same thing is the case with the relationship between God and his creatures, right? So obviously such a being who has such a power deserves to be the object to which we seek refuge and to which we ask for help. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the first three verses of Surah Nas. Inshallah. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
The deal of the century.
Precise technical solutions to make Israelis, Palestinians, and the region safer and much more prosperous.
This deal is not a deal for peace or a peace plan. It is a war plan. Because this legalized the occupation. This plan legalized the settlements. This plan legalized the annexation of Jerusalem. This plan says no return for the Palestinian refugees.
You know, we are the oppressed and they are the oppressors. And they want the oppressed to give more to the oppressor. They want the oppressed to be oppressed more.
What would you do? You will just leave your houses for money, leave your land, leave your life, your memories, your history for money?
The deal of the century. The Trump so-called peace plan, which the Israelis and the United States of America claim